This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This weekend marks 1 year since Heather Heyer was killed as she protested against a Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. As I record this, the city and state have declared a state of emergency, even though the organizer of last year's rally, white supremacist Jason Kessler, says this year's version won't take place in Charlottesville.
He argues that his First Amendment rights were violated when the city denied his permit application. Charlottesville rejected the application in December, saying the proposed event would present a danger to public safety.
He abandoned the legal fight, then posted a message on Twitter saying they will be focusing exclusively on a rally outside the White House at Lafayette Park on August 12th.
Because we're recording Friday afternoon, you know more now than we do about what transpired this weekend in D.C. But whatever the facts on the ground, it is another clash between the First Amendment right to speak and those who take that right to its ugliest violent extreme. Mark Randazza is a lawyer, not a First Amendment absolutist, but pretty close. He's represented fringe actors ranging from the political performance artist Vermin Supreme to the notorious Andrew Anglin, publisher of the neo-Nazi website Daily Stormer, and others of that ilk. One of his newest clients, and maybe his most high profile, is conspiracy theorist and InfoWars host Alex Jones. Jones currently faces multiple lawsuits, including for defamation, filed by family members of Sandy Hook shooting victims.
Sandy Hook is a synthetic, completely fake, with actors, in my view, manufactured. It took me about a year with Sandy Hook to come to grips with the fact that the whole thing was fake. Because the media lies so much, you can't ban free speech of people that are asking questions.
The parents say that 5 years after the shootings, they are still harassed and threatened by Jones' followers. The parents of Noah Posner, the youngest Sandy Hook victim, say they've had to move 7 times, and each time conspiracy theorists have published their address. Mark Randazza, welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you.
Your clients are racists, liars, anti-Semites, slanderers. Why are you working for them?
Well, I wouldn't say that that describes all of my clients. I get along pretty well with Vermin Supreme. You know, the Muslim American Women's Political Action Committee appreciates my pro bono service. You know, some of these people are perhaps not accurately portrayed in the media either. I would say that about Alex Jones. I may not politically agree with him, but think of the absolute worst thing that anybody could possibly say. You need to, as an American, have a knee-jerk reaction to want to protect that. Because if that can be limited, then they can get at any other speech. I look at these people as speed bumps on a runway where someone is charging toward Lady Liberty. And I want these speed bumps to be high, wide, and damage the hell out of any vehicle that's speeding toward her.
However, the First Amendment is in no way absolute, whether in government regulation, criminal cases, or civil litigation.
Sure.
Now, you think Alex Jones is mischaracterized as a conspiracy theorist, but this is a man who claims that the children murdered in the Sandy Hook episode were not, in fact, murdered, that they did not exist, and that their supposed parents are crisis actors, and they're all part of a grand government conspiracy. And what has happened since then is these people have been terrorized by Alex Jones' followers. It is just sick beyond words. It is not political speech. It is the intentional infliction of pain.
I'm going to give you a 50% grade on that statement. The correct part is the First Amendment is not an absolute. I think your characterization my client has caused actual harm is not true. His listeners have harassed these people. That's not him. I know that in the beginning, he did question whether this event happened. He comes from a perspective of, I will never trust our government. That doesn't make him a conspiracy theorist. When the New York Times reported the official government line that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, the New York Times failed to do its job as a member of the Fourth Estate by questioning that official narrative. And as a result, a nation is destroyed, millions of people are dead, and an entire region of the world is destabilized. Now, I realize
I'm going to stop you here because it's preposterous. There were hundreds of contemporaneous eyewitnesses to the Sandy Hook murders. Very few of them were employees of any government, much less the federal government, presumably behind a conspiracy to have
a false flag operation. And well, if you're going to interrupt me, I'm going to interrupt
you. Let me please go. The notion that there is an equivalence between
that and... No, this is not Fox News, sir. I am not going to be treated that way in this interview. Understood?
Okay, go ahead. Please continue, and then I'll ask questions sequentially. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's fine. All right, if he questioned the official narrative, he has a right to do that. I want people to do that. I thought it was preposterous to question whether or not this happened. But a lot of people thought it was preposterous to question whether or not there were actually weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I want to live in a country where someone can do that. After initially questioning whether it happened or not, then he actually came on camera and said, I was wrong. This happened. Nobody wants to report on the fact that the guy went through some deliberative process and actually came to the opposite conclusion.
You know, if he has some late discovered compassion for the Sandy Hook parents, if he's been chastened somehow, you know, it's worth observing that back in February, InfoWars shared a YouTube video claiming that David Hogg, who was one of the survivors of the Parkland shooting in Florida, is a crisis actor. In other words, exactly more of the same.
Well, why can't you be an actual victim and a crisis actor? There's a crisis. They're out there dealing with it in a theatrical way in order to push...
But that's not what crisis actor means. Come on, Mark. It suggests an imposter, an event that never happened, that it was portrayed to have happened by some conspiracy, and that he is not a genuine student at a real high school where real people died, but some sort of prop.
I don't think he's ever said that Parkland didn't happen. I think that saying that he's using the event to push his own agenda is accurate. You know, if your agenda is, hey, I was in a school that got shot up and I want gun rights restricted because of that, man, I applaud those kids. I applaud David Hogg. Any teenager who's going to come out and do what he can to change the world, I don't care what direction he's pushing it in. I'm a fan.
This is Alex Jones speaking. Folks, they staged Aurora. They staged Sandy Hook. The evidence is just overwhelming. The attacks in Orlando were a false flag terrorist attack. All right, never mind. I don't need a response.
Look, I can't defend, I am not going to defend the logic of his statements. I don't agree with them. I don't approve of them. I don't like them. But I like living in a country where he can ask them.
Earlier this week, Alex Jones and his InfoWars program got the virtual boot from three major platforms, Facebook, YouTube, and Apple Podcasts. They washed their hands of him. Is it his intention to sue?
At this point, I have not discussed that with him. I can't tell you what his intentions are at this time.
I want to ask you about another client. I don't know her name. Her screen name on the messaging app called Discord is Crystal Knight.
Mm.
Crystal Knight.
Yeah.
And she was one of the organizers of the Charlottesville white power demonstrations. Among the things she organized was instructing followers what weapons to bring along. Now, there was violence that day, which ended in a woman being killed by one of the right-wing protesters. And there is a court order for the operators of the Discord app to surrender her actual name to be sued for her responsibility for Charlottesville under the general rubric of incitement. And you're fighting that court order. Why?
I disagree that Crystal Knight, wish this wasn't radio, you could see me rolling my eyes at that name. I wish that Ms. Knight had not participated in it at all, but I think to call her an organizer, I think oversells her role in this. There were a lot of people on this board talking about going there and what they should and shouldn't do. And my recollection of her comments were, bring a camera you don't mind losing because somebody might grab it. Don't do certain things that might be considered violent. But yes, I do recall a comment where she said, bring a flagpole so that you can defend yourself if you're attacked. And I think it's awful that that girl got killed. I mean, I don't know why the guy did it, but I certainly know Crystal Knight didn't say, get in your car and drive into a group of protesters. You are only responsible if you advocate imminent lawless action with the intent that that imminent lawless action take place. And neither Andrew Anglin, nor Alex Jones, nor Crystal Knight, I think, are responsible for the lawless action that took place tenuously afterward.
You could certainly make the argument that when you denounce people as criminals or conspirators, or in some cases as subhuman, and your explicit audience acts on that in the most horrendous ways, and you do not immediately intervene by saying, no, no, not that, please don't do that, in fact, double down on your original rhetoric, that signifies intent.
I don't believe so. I believe that what is going on in the Charlottesville case is more about making sure that you can add people's names to the list of people who have to be unpersoned. Like, I don't want Crystal Knight as my dinner guest. I don't want to date her. I don't want to hang out with her. But I think that the right to anonymous speech is very important, especially when it comes to disfavored political groups. I don't think that she has enough responsibility for these events that she should lose her First Amendment right to anonymous speech. You know, if I could pick people to defend that would also be able to defend this neutral principle, I wouldn't pick these people. You go to war with the army you have, not the army you want. These fights are not usually waged by really nice people. It's the Westboro Baptist Church screaming at a poor kid's funeral. It's the Ku Klux Klan. It's the Nazis. It's hardcore pornography. That's what's on that wall. And that wall defends the First Amendment.
I wonder if you can be described as a true exemplar of constitutional purity who just happens to have a client list of some of the most loathsome Americans in the political scene, or whether you are kind of huffing your own fumes, defining yourself by the more or less absolutist stands that you take, that what you're describing is not principle, but just preening, building up an image of yourself.
Hmm.
Is it a fair question? And is it on to something?
It's a fair question. I appreciate being forced into a deeper corner of self-reflection by it. I don't find it even to be offensive. I get the, how can you do that? Why would you do that? I may be wrong. Okay, I may be doing a terrible thing. I mean, L. Reeve from Vice News asked me, I think was the best question anybody ever asked me in an interview, which is America a better or a worse place if you win this case? And I said, I don't know. I don't know. I really don't. I'm not even convinced that we shouldn't have a conversation about how we change what is allowed as far as free speech. But We have a promise that we made to each other. And that promise is that we shall have the broadest and most robust protections for freedom of speech.
Well, Mark, thank you very much.
Thanks, man.
Mark Randazza is a First Amendment lawyer from Las Vegas. He spoke to us from Gloucester, Massachusetts.
If freedom of speech is the cornerstone of democracy, then holding up the other corner is freedom of information. No accountability, no informed electorate, democracy starts to crumble. That's why we have government disclosure laws. We could take this story to Washington, but instead let's go to Missouri, where the former governor and his staff made use of a special app, an app that destroys messages as soon as they're read. Two attorneys are suing former Governor Eric Greitens over his use of the Confide app to communicate with his staffers. Greitens resigned in June in the face of impeachment threats following an extramarital affair and a campaign finance inquiry, but the lawsuit hasn't gone away. Barbara Smith, an attorney representing the governor's office, argued in June that the state's public records law doesn't apply because the records don't exist, because the app deleted them. Mark Pedroli is one of the attorneys suing Greitens.
Most of the governor's office had the app, and they were using it to communicate with one another about public business.
How do you know that?
Well, we actually just recently were able to prove that with what I would call a smoking gun. It was a text message where two people who were also communicating on Confide were talking off of Confide about their communications on Confide, if you follow that.
Yes.
It was the draft document on a policy argument. I can't read your corrections on Confide.
Oh.
So please send it to me normally so I can read the changes that you made to this policy document. So it was a clear case of people discussing public business. And think about it, how lucky was that? That was sort of a needle in the haystack to be able to get a conversation on a regular text message about a conversation that wasn't working on Confide.
It might help us to know a little bit more about Greitens, who was this rising star in the Republican Party.
Right. He had connections to the vice president's office, to all of these people who were terrific fundraisers. And another key point is Greitens had raised a tremendous sum of money from outside of the state, dark money coming in. The idea of them using Confide, I mean, it was always a deep concern to me because of the dark money. When you're raising millions of dollars for 501c3s, ANU Missouri was an example of a 501c3 that raised millions of dollars.
These are PACs.
It's a PAC to serve the governor's interests. But the problem is we don't know if there's one donor or 20, and we don't know how much they're getting and what do they want. These could be, you know, extremely wealthy people from out of state who just want something, you know, long term, or these could be corporations in state who want policies changed for profit.
So, to deal with money issues that you don't want to disclose, you go on Confide. I understand he also was accused of illegally obtaining a donor list to a charity he founded and using it to raise money for his campaign.
Well, that was an allegation that was made by the House of Representatives in Missouri. After he stepped down and resigned, most of these investigations went away. And I do believe there were a lot of people on the committee who spearheaded this investigation into Governor Greitens who did not want the investigation to go away. So they have filed other complaints with various agencies in Missouri. There are at least three, four, or five investigations that were ongoing about wrongful or criminal activity.
The story, however, most people outside the state would be familiar with, if they've ever heard of Governor Eric Greitens at all, would be his affair.
Sure. There was an allegation of a photograph taken non-consensually of the woman, where it possibly dovetailed into the use of apps like Confide that destroy the communication. If someone took a photograph of somebody and they wanted to send it, maybe they would use that app. Now, we filed our suit long before that story broke. There was some discussion by the prosecutor's office in St. Louis where they said that Confide was at the heart of their case. So there must have been some concerns that Confide was also used for that.
Is there a situation in which Greitens and his staff might have used the Confide app
for perfectly legitimate reasons. I mean, does it necessarily mean that there was some communication going on that should have been in the public domain?
We already know that they did. The next question is, to what extent did the use of Confide go in discussing public business? Was it 90%? Was it group texts? We don't know, because the app destroys the communications. Like I told the judge in this case, there's always been three tools for us to find out what they communicated about. One is a subpoena to Confide and asking them. Two, a forensic expert that can look at the particles and the artifacts on that phone to recreate messages. But the easiest tool is deposition testimony. I want to go to the staff, I want to go to the governor, and I want to sit down and I want to ask them, well, what did you talk about? Because frankly, at this point in time, I think that there's going to be a lot of people who are going to tell me the truth. Right before we filed the lawsuit, Attorney General Josh Hawley opened an inquiry into the use of Confide in the governor's office. And I think five people admitted to using it in some way dealing with government business, but they said it was purely logistical. They said this was about planning meetings.
They made restaurant reservations on Confide.
The whole state of Missouri collectively laughed when that was the answer. That's the last thing you do on Confide, set up logistics and meetings, because there's nothing to go reference after you send it to know what time you have to be there. The idea that they said this was just crazy, and people couldn't believe it.
You said the easiest way to move ahead with your lawsuit, which is in discovery now, is to depose the governor and his staff.
And I have asked the judge. The judge said, not now. This is where it gets interesting. The judge granted a stay to the current governor, the new governor, because they had asked for a stay of discovery on all my depositions. I had served subpoenas to people who had used Confide because they were one of the 20 people that was turned over pursuant to court order. You know, I was probably days away from sitting down and finally getting into this communications network. And what the judge did was he told me to sequentially do my discovery. So he said, sequence one will be send your subpoena to Confide. See if they have the communications. If they don't, then go to sequence two. Sequence two is make an argument to me that there might be some of these communications on their physical phones. And maybe there's a way we can get a forensic expert to look at the phones. And if that doesn't yield any of the actual messages that were sent and received on Confide, come back to me later and ask for further discovery. We are doing that now. The new governor is going to make an argument, probably through an expert, that we can't get the messages from the forensics on the phone, that we're not going to be able to get it through Confide. Then they're going to say, because they've already indicated this, that the case should be dismissed.
Now, the thing is that you can find out who has Confide on their phone because you can just go to Confide and look it up with a phone number.
Right. And here's the problem, though, is because when the Kansas City Star reporter Jason Hancock wrote the story in December of last year, my guess is that it shocked the Office of Governor. A lot of people probably dropped their accounts. So what happened is the Attorney General came in. This is a very political issue here, too, in Missouri, because as you may or may not understand, our attorney general is running against Claire McCaskill for the Senate. It's a big national election. Obviously, everyone's going to be, you can bet on it, dumping a lot of money in the state of Missouri. He's a Republican. Greitens was a Republican. He had to investigate, opened an inquiry into it. But what he did not do, which was my complaint, was file a lawsuit. He deprived himself of the primary tool of any litigator, and that's the power of the court to issue a subpoena for evidence. Mm-hmm. So instead, what he did was he went in and had interviews with the people in the governor's office. Well, what ended up happening was the governor's office told him that there was only five or eight people who had used Confide. Fast forward a few months later, after my lawsuit, we had subpoena power. We got a court order from the judge telling the Office of Governor to turn over the names and the phone numbers of all the people who used Confide in the governor's office. And it went from eight people to 20. Our lawsuit yielded more information than an attorney general inquiry, which raises a whole host of questions. For example, can the Office of Governor lie to the top cop of the state? What's the fallout if you do?
So when do you get to go to trial?
Well, hopefully any day now, we're going to get the information from Confide, because they've already publicly announced on Twitter that they don't have anything.
Mm-hmm.
Next step is we go to the judge, we talk to an expert, a forensic expert, to determine whether or not these 20 people and their 20 cell phones can somehow be forensically analyzed to reproduce messages that were sent on Confide. If the answer to that is no, then we go to our third tool. The judge should allow me to take the depositions of the people who used Confide to determine the extent of its use to conduct public business. That will probably happen either at the end of the summer or early fall. And let me add that in the governor's office, they did issue public phones. But if you ask me my opinion, those public phones were put in a drawer. One of the documents that was produced said, never use your public phone to conduct public business by text. So it did look like it was designed to evade the law. It was a conspiracy.
It's hard to believe that this is happening on the state level so widely and on the federal level.
This is what's always captured me about 501c4s and dark money groups.
Mm-hmm.
The state laws, there's a race to the bottom on protecting the privacy of people to drive in more money in capital investment or incorporation in these states. And it's very disturbing.
When you talk about LLCs and these dark money groups, how do they function?
Any way they want. An LLC is just an organizational stamp. They could just exist, have a bank account, and write checks.
But if you give money to a candidate, you have to disclose that, right?
But what if you give it to A New Missouri, which was the name of the 501c4? And what if the person that's giving it to them is a front? I mean, even banks have know your customer laws. And there's no way to know who the top donors were to my governor. So if you add dark money and dark communications, tell me how foreign governments won't be able to pour in millions of dollars. It's easy.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Mark Pedroli is a Missouri attorney suing former Governor Eric Greitens for allegedly violating open records laws. His organization is called the Sunshine Project. We tried to reach the former governor's office and his associates from those days. We never heard back.
Coming up, why we have to start fighting fire with fire.
This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Tonight, it's now a historic emergency. The largest fire ever in California, now bigger than the size of Los Angeles.
That's the Mendocino Complex fire. And officials warn that it won't be fully contained until September. The Carr fire, meanwhile, has damaged 1,000 homes. Arson is thought to be the cause of the Holy Fire, which has forced the evacuation of 20,000 people. The charges against the suspect could land him in jail for life.
As firefighters try to manage the 15 wide-scale blazes in California, across the Atlantic, Spain and Portugal are also battling raging wildfires. Last month, we heard the story of Greek citizens fleeing a fire into the sea and drowning.
It was like a sea of fire, a wave of fire.
This year's conflagrations have made familiar landscapes alien to us, but one thing in these fiery times remains unchanged. Presidential politicking via Twitter.
California wildfires are being magnified and made so much worse by the bad environmental laws which aren't allowing massive amounts of readily available water to be properly utilized. It is being diverted into the Pacific Ocean. Must also tree clear to stop fire from spreading.
I have no idea what he's talking about. Wildland fires are not like urban fires. It's not just a case of opening a hydrant and squirting water.
Stephen J. Pine is a former firefighter, self-described pyromantic, and author of 25 books on wildland fires.
You would have to divert the Sacramento River to put those fires out. So that is just nonsense from start to finish. I don't know what that's about, except just a way to beat up on environmental issues. One of the things about fire is that it is very often used to animate some other message. If you've got a theme, a topic, something you want to promote, if you can put a picture or footage of fire, you're going to get attention. And that's what I suspect is going on here. But fire has its own story. It has its own problems with reporting and journalism.
And let's get to those. What do the media tend to get the most wrong?
Well, they've always relied on two templates. One is fire is a disaster.
Oh, it seems like we just got done with last year's fire season here in California, which was nothing short of disastrous. And here we go again, sadly.
Fire often is a disaster, but not only a disaster. And the other is
fighting these fires has been like waging a war.
The firefight is battlefield.
More than 4,000 firefighters continue to battle the Mendocino complex fires.
We're not at war with fire. And if we are, we're going to take a lot of casualties, we're going to spend a lot of money, and we're going to lose. If I were to frame the larger story, and I do this as a fire historian, I would say the problem is that we have too much bad fire, too little good fire, and too much combustion. And that means we have too many fires that are burning communities, killing people. At the same time, we have too few good fires, substituting for them, getting our landscapes into a more habitable shape. And as far as the business of houses burning, it really bubbled up in California in the post-war era, considered a kind of California quirk, and then suddenly it's all over the West. But it's not staying in the West. It's burned outside Austin, Texas.
Several are burning near the capital city of Austin, and the only way to battle the quick-moving fires is from the air.
In Gatlinburg, Tennessee, it's burning out along the coastal plains.
The people here, they're surprised, they're devastated.
It's more than 14,000 people fled Gatlinburg that night.
It's not something that can be quarantined off in California or just restricted as another freak of Western violence like grizzly bear attacks or something. Suddenly, this is a national problem.
I want to ask you about this notion of good fire and bad fire.
Mm-hmm.
Fires that burn a lot of timber have their place in the life cycle of forests. How is that so?
Fires started on Earth as soon as plants colonized the land. It emerges out of life. Life created the oxygen. Life created the fuel. Think of this as creative destruction in nature's economy. By removing fire or trying to remove fire, we've deteriorated the ecological health and integrity of these systems, and one of the manifestations is to allow a pileup of combustibles that make more dangerous and damaging fires possible.
Then there's managed fires that are created as a firefighting tool.
Well, this is actually a very ancient practice. Part of what made us human was being able to cook. And in a sense, we soon learned to cook landscapes. And to be able to distribute fire on the landscape is an enormous power.
But particularly over the last number of decades, strategies for managing fire have changed. What was the turning point in the United States?
The Great Fires of 1910 put us into a kind of full suppression mode. It traumatized the young Forest Service. And for 50 years, the country tried to remove fire from lands as much as it could. By the 1960s, the consequences of that were becoming more and more apparent. A real deterioration of many landscapes, a lot of grasslands were being overtaken by woody plants and becoming really unattractive and unusable, as well as major fire traps. So in 1968, the National Park Service adopted a fire restoration program. By 1978, the Forest Service had come on board. So all of the apparatus were all in place 40 to 50 years ago. And it was predicted if we didn't solve this, we would have ever-growing fire problems. The 70s and early 80s were really the last time all the contributing factors were more or less benign enough that if we moved at scale, we could have deflected the trajectory of the whole system.
And then what happened? And I actually know the answer to this. It's Yellowstone.
1988, Yellowstone burned and kept burning week after week for several months, and the media camped out there.
Fires bore down on a national icon, the Old Faithful Inn.
There are a lot of angry people who believe that the National Park Service is responsible, that it let the fires burn too freely for too long.
The New York Times documentary series Retro Report delved into the public pressure officials faced as the wildfire ravaged the park.
President Reagan moved to deal with a firestorm of protest over his administration's let it burn policy.
Area ranchers said the let it burn attitude makes no sense.
And by then, everything is working in the wrong direction, and it has been a steady ratcheting up of worsening conditions. And it's very unlikely that we will be able to get ahead of them, except in very local areas. There's no reason for communities to be burning. We know how to keep houses from burning. We just have to rethink and commit to doing it.
Well, what could we have done to prevent those 1,000 homes that have been rendered cinders in the car fire?
Well, the main vehicle for taking out these houses are not these tsunamis of flame. It's blizzards of sparks, millions of embers flying around ahead of the fire. And if there is any point of vulnerability in the house, the roof, combustible vegetation right next to wooden siding, then that becomes a point of ignition. Once you get several houses on the fringe burning, then it becomes an urban fire and it's simply going house to house. How did we solve the urban fire problem? Well, by codes, zoning, ordinances, hardening those houses, identifying the points of vulnerability. Some communities are now proactively putting in these kinds of considerations into new construction, but what do we do with 40 or 50 years of poorly conceived construction? How do we retrofit? Because if we don't do it, fire will do it for us.
A recent cover of The Economist shows firefighters facing a blaze, and the headline is, "In the Line of Fire, Losing the War Against Climate Change." Is that making too big an assumption?
Well, I think that's another example of using fire to animate another topic. You know, fire is a reaction, and I think of it as a driverless car. It's barreling down the highway, integrating everything around it. And at sometimes this may be, you know, a tricky intersection that we call wildland-urban interface. It may be a dangerous curve we call climate change. It may be a lot of road debris. We would still have a fire problem if the climate was the same as it had been in the 70s. But climate change is certainly aggravating and acting on that.
Are we indeed in a crisis, or is this just a little bit more of the same?
Well, it's more of the same, but if you want to get media or political or public attention, you've got to burn up a bunch of houses and kill people or involve celebrities. So 400 acres outside Santa Barbara, California is worth 400,000 outside Winnemucca. In fact, Winnemucca had 450,000 acres burned earlier this year, and I don't think anybody knew about it. But there's a deeper story in which there's a slow disaster unfolding, which is the absence of good fire in so many places that need it. And in the absence of tame fire, we're just going to have feral fires, which is what we're seeing.
So I'm an editor. Your advice to me is to go to Florida. That's where they're doing managed fires, and see if that policy might be exported elsewhere, even the hedonists in Southern California.
Well, we've been trying for 50 years to export the Florida model, and it hasn't worked as well as we'd like. And I think what Western fire officers are now doing is trying to work with fire, a managed wildfire, if you can accept that. They're half suppression, half prescribed fire. It's a very interesting fusion, different from what we see in Florida, different from what we've had before. And I think we're seeing a phase change, at least in the wildland fire community, in that direction.
We've been talking about the overall ecosystem. And we've also talked a bit about the media ecosystem. how we tend to focus on celebrities and, you know, multi-million dollar yeah. houses cantilevered over some canyon. Is the media ecosystem making it harder for us as a society to deal with the overall realities of wildfires?
You know, the media ecosystem is following the public ecosystem. This is what people want to hear. You expect to see air tankers flying around, giant helicopters dropping water, whether they're really helpful or not. There's a certain amount of political theater, a certain amount of media display. So I don't necessarily blame the media. I would like the media to begin shifting, nudging, if you will, the story. But where is the human drama narrative, the interest narrative that is going to allow the media to tell this other story in a way that doesn't penalize them? You know, you're putting on this new story and your competitor is putting on the old, here we are, the troops out fighting the fire. It's a disaster raging. Who's going to get the audience? So we need to come up with good, tough, working narratives that can serve our purpose. And I don't know that that's the job of the media. It would be great if you did it, but I think that's also the task of academics and writers and artists and the rest of us to give you something that can be as compelling as the firefight, because we're not going to get ahead of these problems. Very few of them are under the control of the fire community itself. You know, it's an old saying, it's better to be lucky than good, and we better hope we're lucky in the next decade or so.
Steve, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome.
Fire historian Stephen J. Pine is a professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University.
Coming up, the reporter who's covered more than 400 Texas executions is retiring, but plans to keep attending.
This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Texas has 115 prisons. Six of them are in Huntsville. The Texas Prison Museum in Huntsville holds Old Sparky, the electric chair built by prisoners, incidentally, that shocked 361 prisoners to death from 1924 to 64. Now, of course, they die by lethal injection.
Huntsville's main street is an unimposing place. It's Texas's version of quaint small-town America. Yet a quarter of this city's population is made up of convicted criminals.
Huntsville, Texas, is a prison town through and through.
The Texas State Penitentiary at Huntsville, also sometimes known as the Huntsville Unit.
Death row inmates are brought to this unit where they spend their final hours.
While the prisoner eats his final meal, the men and women who will witness the execution begin to arrive at the prison.
The role of the witnesses by law is to confirm that an individual was actually executed. People volunteer to do this.
One such person is reporter Michael Grochek. He retired, sort of, from the Associated Press on July 31st after nearly 46 years in journalism and after more than 400 trips to the Huntsville unit.
So you climb these steps, go through a series of electronic doors. You walk through a small courtyard and you reach the death chamber. And you walk into the viewing area, the witness area. It's a narrow rectangular room. If you stood in the center of it and extended your arms, you could probably touch each wall. You stand and you look through jail bars that are encased in plexiglass. There's a gurney that is bolted to the floor. The warden stands at the inmate's head. There's a chaplain that stands at the inmate's feet. You can hear what he or she says and whatever sounds they make as the drugs take effect. When we're all assembled, a prison official will open a door and tell the warden, "Warden, you may proceed."
Is there an execution that stuck with you long after the fact?
I remember walking in there and the inmate, Robert Black, said to me, "Hi, Mike, how you doing?" I didn't know how to react. I mean, you can't get caught up in the emotion of the moment. You also have to be aware of your environment. And let's say, for instance, I'm in there among the witnesses who lost a loved one because of what this inmate did. You don't want to show any expressions of, "Gee, I like this person." All these things are going through your mind as someone says, "Hi, Mike, how are you doing?" If I could have a do-over, there was one that I would change. There was an inmate by the name of Raymond Carl Kinneman. He tried to wriggle out of the restraints. And the chaplain usually rests his hand on the inmate's leg as a form of comfort. And as Kinneman is struggling to get out of the restraints, I wrote that the chaplain was holding his leg with his hand. So when the story got published and people on death row were reading the story, they perceived that as the chaplain assisting in the death of their friend. And the chaplain was threatened and he had to be replaced and moved elsewhere. I cost him his job there. If I'd have said that the chaplain was resting his hand on the inmate's leg at the time, that would have been certainly better than saying he was holding the inmate's leg. And if I could change that, I would.
Do you have to mentally prepare yourself differently?
No, I don't think so. No special kind of preparation or mindset, at least not for me. As a reporter, you go to a lot of situations where you have no clue what's going to happen and you have to be, you know, aware of what might happen. I've done a lot of sports stories where somebody makes a last second shot or makes a basket or scores a touchdown or something. That's actually good preparation for dealing with news in the real world. And as an AP reporter, you're just exposed to this all the time.
The possibility of something unanticipated happening has a whole different quality from the sports analogy that you just offered. Have you never found yourself emotionally invested in the process with a given person on death row?
Now, I've gotten to know a number of these people quite well. You cannot get emotionally invested. You just can't, because if you do, then you begin losing objectivity. And you also can't forget why they are in the situation they are.
If they did it, I mean, there has been so much talk about people on death row not belonging there and later exonerated by DNA or eyewitness testimony.
And I will point that out in stories if that is necessary. But in Texas, it has not been determined that an innocent person has been put to death. I feel pretty comfortable saying that I have not seen anyone who has been found innocent after the fact put to death.
Even though you're retiring, you're not entirely laying down your pen.
I don't think I just want to totally divorce myself from being a reporter or a writer. I do like what I've done. I will not do the daily kind of grind. That's part of the reason why you get out of this. But at the same time, I can go in there and cover that story for that day and then leave and wait for the next one.
Is it simply because they happen rarely enough and you're so experienced in covering them? Or are you drawn to them?
I don't know that I'm drawn to them. It's something that I've grown to do. I'm not some groupie. I don't walk around with a cloud over my head. I'm not the Grim Reaper. It's news, and I like covering news. I'm not a robot. I do have sensitivities, but I leave them at the door when I'm covering a story.
Has covering it changed the way you think about the death penalty?
I frankly don't discuss that. I don't know if I'm for or against it. I don't know. I mean, I've talked to all kinds of people on both sides, and it's a conundrum. And for me, professionally, it is so much easier to just go right down the center and explain the sides and leave it at that.
Mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't sound like you would approach this any differently from a traffic accident.
Depends on the traffic accident, Brooke. Mm-hmm. These are important stories. I try not to over-dramatize them. And if people decide they want a more hyped version of the story, they can look elsewhere and try to find it from there.
Yeah, and I know that's what you think that I'm saying. But what I'm really saying is that if there isn't a particular gravity to what's going on here, why does it need to be covered at all unless it goes wrong?
You know, it's kind of like the space shuttle. People just take it for granted until it blows up. And that's kind of the premise, I think, of your question. That, well, just because the rockets are being launched, that we shouldn't care about that unless it blows up. A death penalty is very similar.
If you cover it that way, there are people opposed to the death penalty that say it should be public viewing because we ought to see what the government is doing in our name.
I've had inmates tell me that they ought to do it on the 50-yard line on Sundays. If that's the way they did it, then we'd be there to cover it as well.
What do you think the impact would be if these were publicly viewable in real time?
I think they would be exploited horribly. But if people are looking for shock value, they're not going to get it. The way the drugs work is the inmate may say that he can taste it or that he can smell it or that it's hot or that it's cold. And he'll take a few deep breaths and he'll gasp a little bit. Then he begins to snore, usually. And then there's no further movement. And this all takes place within less than a minute and in some cases less than 30 seconds. I've had other reporters tell me after seeing it for their first time that, gee, that was anticlimactic. And it really is.
After covering 429 of them, is it boring?
No, it can't be boring. No. There's a certain routine to it, and I hesitate calling it routine because I don't think it should be routine when the state takes anyone's life. So let's say there's a certain sameness to them, but no, it's not boring.
You're seeing pretty much the same thing over and over and over again.
It's news. It's what I do. And if I get bored by it, then you need to have somebody else go in there and do it.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Michael Grachik is a recently retired AP reporter still on the job.
That's it for this week's show on the media. It's produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Asta Chaturvedi. And this week, we say goodbye to our wonderful intern, Meg Harney, whose audio editing ear is exceeded only by her enthusiasm.
Bye, Meg.
Bye, Meg. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.